today on Against the Grain. If the people need to rise up and create an alternative to the status quo, that suggests they can do the kinds of strategic work that leads to fundamental political transformation. But can social movements do such a thing, or should they rely on their leaders to do it? I'm CS. The political theorist Michael Hart joins me to discuss movements, leaders, what he calls the common, and more, coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. 18 years have elapsed since Michael Hart and Antonio Negri published a major work of political theory called Empire. That book, together with the two that followed, with the titles Multitude and Commonwealth, formed what's called the Empire Trilogy. Then came the volume Declaration, published in 2012, and last year saw the arrival of Hart and Negri's latest foray into debates over what social movements and the left can accomplish in the face of current systems of domination. That foray, that book, has the title Assembly. Michael Hart is a political philosopher and professor of literature based at Duke University. He also co-directs the Social Movements Lab at the John Hope Franklin Humanities Institute. When Michael joined me from a studio on the Duke campus, he began with these remarks about what prompted the writing of Assembly.
Well, this book project starts for me and Tony really with 2011, and both the enthusiasm for a variety of movements across the world, and then starting with the Arab Spring, Tunisia and Egypt, moving to Spain and Greece, finally arriving across the Atlantic with Zuccotti Park and the various forms of Occupy. And we felt like these movements were inspiring for many people, in fact, expressed the desires and aspirations for democracy of so many people, and yet we're not able to transform our societies in a more just and democratic direction. So that for us already poses a conundrum about organization and leadership, because precisely all of these movements in 2011 are called at least leaderless movements. They're in fact experimenting with new forms of organization. So that at least is an initial inspiration for us, or a need for us, it seems, to rethink questions about organization and leadership.
What did you see going on within the movements you mentioned in terms of discussions around leadership and decision-making?
Well, it seemed to us that within the movements themselves, there seemed to be a false choice after 2011, or you could say after 2013, because certainly Gezi Park movement is part of this. Even continuing on further, I would say that the various parts of Black Lives Matter movements, in fact, go under this too. I think within the movements, there's been a false choice between a pure horizontalism, that is a refusal of leadership and really institutional structures in all forms, or a return to older traditional forms of centralization and leadership, often in the form of some sort of party or vanguard party. And it seems to us that that's not really the choice. In that sense, the conundrum of either leaderlessness or an old-fashioned centralized form of leadership, that's what seemed to us a conundrum that had to be addressed.
Leaders of movements, when movements have leaders, are thought to have the unique ability to do the strategic planning required to advance the movement's goals. What's your take on this?
Exactly. I think we have to recognize the roles that leaders have played in revolutionary movements in the past. Leaders, single charismatic leaders, but also central committees, leadership structures, etc. To recognize the roles they have played, like you say, most importantly even for strategic planning, for decision making, and recognize how we could accomplish them otherwise. So this doesn't seem to us a refusal of leadership as such, but mechanisms for accomplishing what leadership structures have done in the past and accomplishing that in a different way. So, for instance, both the ability to make political decisions, but also the ability to institutionalize, to make last of movement. These are at least two of the characteristics that leadership structures have been responsible for in the past.
Is there a concern on your and Antonio Negri's part that leaders, when they do strategy, when they are entrusted to do strategy or just do strategy, that there's a danger involved there, that there's something that is taken away from the masses, from the movements?
I would say that at least the last 50 years, in a variety of countries, the U.S. and really every national context, there has been a questioning, an undermining of the undemocratic nature of leadership structures. Think of it, here would be the most easily accessed example, I think, when the U.S. is think about various practices within feminist movements in the 1970s and 1980s, the insistence that everyone speaks at a meeting in various consciousness-raising formats, the refusal to allow people to speak to the media in the name of the group. These are all practices that are trying to undermine the undemocratic nature of centralized leadership structures. I think that's also gone on in anti-racist struggles, in student movements, in labor movements, in a whole variety of struggles, this questioning and even undermining of the structures of the centralized and hence undemocratic forms of leadership. So I think we have to build on and learn from where the movements are. I mean, here's another way of looking at it, if you like. This seems like a perfectly realist way of saying it, which is the movements as they are today, social movements as they are today, have created a kind of allergy to leadership structures. They're really constituted in such a way that leadership structures in their traditional form really can't take hold. So for better or for worse, you know, there are these antibodies floating around that are going to attack any leadership structure that evolves. So it seems to me not even a viable option, just being realistic, that one could try to impose traditional centralized leadership structures on the movements. What one has to do instead, this is the only realistic option, it seems to me, is to try to develop forms of organization and institution that accomplish what traditional leadership structures have done, but do it in a democratic form. That's really what I think is required.
So what are you and Mr. Negri arguing in terms of how responsibility should be allocated, ideally, between leadership structures and movements? Because you still do want, quote, leaders in some sense. You want them to do certain things. So what do you feel comfortable leaders doing and the movements in general doing?
The way Tony and I think of it is, and not as an answer, this is not a solution, this is a framework for thinking about a solution, is that there has to be an inversion of strategy and tactics, in the sense that, as you were already saying, that the traditional format in revolutionary movements and various forms of liberation movements has been that leaders have been given the responsibility of strategy, thinking in the long term, making decisions over the most important issues, seeing far, understanding the entire social field. That's strategy, and leaders have been responsible for that. Whereas the people themselves, the movement, have been responsible for tactics, localized actions, even localized decision-making. What we think needs to happen is an inversion of that, that there still should be structures for leadership. There are times when we do need decisions made in a short term. Some decisions require expertise. These are things that leaders should be assigned. You know, here's the stupidest example or the easiest example. You know, any good demonstration requires that you have certain people that are not only responsible for security, but that can monitor to figure where the police have blocked off this street and we need to turn on this street, or how to stop people from being arrested, or how to get people out of jail once they are arrested. I mean, these seem to us like a kind of tactical leadership that can be assigned and dismissed for temporary means. Whereas And this is the much harder part. Whereas the multitude or the people or the movement themselves in a democratic way have to be responsible for strategy. Like I said, for making decisions over the most important questions, for making long-term plans, for assuring continuity. That's a much harder question. In fact, I would say that the majority of the book is our trying to understand and even test that the multitude could be capable of strategy. How is it that people can decide democratically over the most important political questions? How are we going to be capable of that? That's really our question. That seems to me the most important question that arises from this thinking about organization.
So Multitude, which was the name of one of your earlier books, part of the Empire Trilogy, Multitude is a word with a very specific meaning in that book. You've referred to the multitude, the movements, the people. Are you kind of bringing them all together, those terms, or is there something about the multitude which you are suggesting in this book, Assembly, is kind of the entity, the population out of which will emerge this strategy to confront the status quo? Are you saying that the multitude specifically has a role? So I guess I'm wondering what the multitude is and how to differentiate that from the masses.
Sometimes casually I use them interchangeably, the people, the movement, the multitude, the masses, but that's really only to try to just communicate with people where they are with the terms they use. Tony and I do understand multitude in a relatively specific way, but I think one that is pretty easily understand with where other people are. What we're really trying to designate is a population in struggle that includes real differences. So that would be the contrast to the notion of the people. The people is often, at least, thought of as a unity and even relatively homogeneous. Or rather, the notion of the people itself starts to function like an identity. We want rather, and it seems to us important rather, to emphasize the real differences that exist within the people in struggle and to insist nonetheless that we can struggle together, that we can struggle in common. You know, so here's one way to approach it, if this is a vocabulary that works for you. You know, we were inspired at a certain point and learned a great deal at a certain point from the concept of intersectionality that comes really through a Black feminist, U.S. Black feminist origin, and then has become extremely important concept within women's studies and feminist studies. And part of what it does, I guess it's really twofold, is one is to emphasize the radical plurality of differences, often, I suppose, in identity terms. And then the other side is the possibility or the need for coalition, you know, for political struggle to recognize those differences and then to pose coalition. For instance, the Combahee River Collective Statement was one original point of that, let's say. So that's one way of approaching what multitude should be, is through that notion of coalition. The hesitation should be, but this is also a discussion within those who use the term intersectionality too, is that for us, multitude shouldn't be thought of as just a set of identities that then have external relations to one another. And that's the caution with any notion about coalition. But rather, multitude is a way that we can, like we would put it, I hope this can make sense, as a set of becomings, like that all of these differences are also becoming different and becoming different in struggle together. So it's not a model, I guess this is the basic thing. It's not a model that we have to be unified in order to be strong. You know, we don't have to say we're all after one thing. We all don't have to say we are the same, but it's finding ways to recognize the social multiplicity, social plurality, if you like, but that can nonetheless struggle in common. That's what's important to us about the concept of multitude. And I think if you look at all of the social movements around us, is really crucial and basic for activists in practice.
Michael Hart joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. He teaches at Duke University, and we are talking about his latest book, co-authored with Antonio Negri. It's called Assembly. It's published by Oxford University Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain. Okay, so if leadership should do tactics and movements, or the multitude should do strategy, then the question is, and you posed it a bit earlier this hour, is can the multitude do strategy? How will the multitude do strategy? And this is a big discussion. It occupies a large portion of this book, Assembly, but maybe we could start with what you stress in this book about cooperation and social cooperation and existing circuits of cooperation, already existing circuits, amongst the multitude. So can we start there? Like, what do you see as kind of bringing the multitude together despite the fact that they live in different places, they have different employers, some people don't work or can't work? What's the kind of cooperation from which you draw some encouragement?
In many senses, this question, is the multitude capable of strategy? It really overlaps strongly with a maybe more familiar question, which is, are people really capable of democracy? In other words, I don't mean, you know, can they go out and vote in elections every once in a while? What I mean is, can people collectively govern themselves, collectively make political decisions? And that's that too, it's just another way of posing what is really a quite difficult question. You have to ask what are people's capacities in their daily lives? I mean, I don't think anyone should assume that people are born and spontaneously have the ability to collectively govern themselves, to make political decisions together. So for Tony and I, looking at people's capacities in their daily lives, for Tony and I, it does pass through a economic register, you know, through labor, but labor thought quite broadly. It's not just what people do at work, you know, like what people do for a wage. We think labor or really social production in a quite expanded frame, like how people produce social value in cooperation with each other. And in fact, it's those circuits of cooperation in social production that seemed to us one key for recognizing people's capacities for political self-rule, you know, for collective decision-making. So that leads us through quite extensive, I guess, economic analysis about capital today, how capital today primarily extracts values that are produced socially, and that analyzing the way that people produce value socially, that capital subsequently extracts, that gives us a key or a lens through which to recognize people's capacities for, you know, like I say, when we say for people cooperating together, creating new circuits of cooperation and social production, strongly overlaps with their capacities for making political decisions together.
Financial mechanisms and finance, you argue, have been deployed more and more by the bosses, the capitalist bosses. What impact has that had on the relationship between capitalist mechanisms of command and workers, with that term construed broadly?
Yeah, big question. But let me actually start back. I hope I can do this quickly enough for it to make sense for us. I would say, or Tony and I start from an hypothesis in a way that capital functions primarily today through extraction, through extracting values that are produced elsewhere. So you could start by thinking, and many authors do, Tony and I started this thinking with scholars and activists in Argentina, that capital functions today in large part through the extraction of oil, of minerals, even thinking of monocultural agriculture as a kind of extraction of wealth that it finds, seemingly free for the taking, an old colonialist imaginary, and extracts them from the earth. Well, in the same way, it seems to us, capital functions by extracting social values. Like, as a kind of hinge, think about the metaphor of data mining. Data mining is seemingly the same kind of extraction, like it's a kind of mining. data might even sound inert. You know, the kind of data mining that Facebook does or that social media, that functions through social media, et cetera. What they are, you know, data sounds inert like it's just, I don't know, your age and height or something like that. But actually what's getting mined are forms of intelligence, social relations, things, forms of social wealth that are being produced, you know, often on social media by users, et cetera. So that might give you a key to thinking about how capital functions, say, in platform capitalism, you know, like in social media and various similar forms, Uber. Capital functions not by producing values the way it did in the factory. In other words, by organizing cooperation itself. That's the way capital functioned in the factory. But rather by extracting values that are produced by relatively autonomous social cooperation. Like, that's where we're going with this. So finance, to come back to that question, finance might be at the end of that entire line of reasoning, that finance functions, at least in large part, as a mechanism to extract values, extract and accumulate values that are produced socially outside of its direct organization. I hope that sequence made some sense.
Yeah, it does. And so when you said outside of its direct organization, are you saying that a gap has opened between finance and capitalists more generally and workers, or maybe that gap has widened in recent years?
I think it's definitely widened, but start already with the early 20th century readings of Finance Capital, Rudolf Hilferding, Lenin himself. One thing they posed is they were thinking of this in spatial terms, that what finance represents is a distance between the banker, the holder of financial capital, and the organization of production. So the values were being produced in the industrial context for them, early 20th century, but the profits were being accumulated at a distance by the banker. That's a similar thing. You could say that gap, like you were just pointing out exactly, that's a gap, and that gap perhaps has widened. So there are two things you could also react about that gap. On the one hand, you could be outraged, indignant at the injustice. Yes, of course. But the second thing you might think about is, at least in the context of social production, that there is a certain potential, certainly not automatic, but a potential for autonomy that's marked by that gap. I'm talking in somewhat abstract metaphorical terms here, but I hope it makes sense, because what we want to say, here's another way of getting at the same question. When Marx is writing mid-19th century about industrial production, when he talks about cooperation, for those Marxologists in the room, chapter 13 of volume 1 of Capital, when he talks about cooperation, it's the one time in the book where the capitalist has a intrinsic role. The capitalist is not a parasite, because what the capitalist is necessary for is to institute and organize cooperation, creating the site for the workers to cooperate, bringing them together, even disciplining them, forcing them to cooperate, giving them the mechanisms to cooperate, etc. So in some ways, cooperation in that context comes from above. I would say that by and large in social cooperation today, the kind of social cooperation, the values of which are extracted by finance capital or by platform capital for finance through platform capital, cooperation primarily arises from below. And that's actually, I think, an important difference, or at least my metaphor of above and below give an idea of a possibility that could look outside of and beyond capital that is intrinsic in these forms of cooperation.
I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Michael Hart is professor of literature and a political philosopher based at Duke University. He's co-author with Antonio Negri of the Empire Trilogy, consisting of the volumes Empire, Multitude, and Commonwealth. The two have also authored the book Declaration, and their latest book is Assembly. You and Antonio Negri are also interested in the kinds of knowledges that workers have access to, and in some case, the knowledges built up, let's say in relationship to machines and machine systems, that the knowledge about these things that workers have built up that may actually exceed what the bosses, what the capitalists actually have. Can you talk about that and also talk about what resources those knowledges might have for this project of developing a strategy among the multitude, by the multitude?
That's great. I think you're right that we should, one could thematize, and one should do this in many frameworks, that those below have superior knowledge. So the instance you were just mentioning is, and this has long been part of the arguments for self-management, you know, in the various self-management movements of factories in the course of the 20th century, which is that the workers do know how everything works, how to make everything. The engineer doesn't even know, and certainly the factory owner or the bosses don't know. They actually know how everything goes together in the car and how everything is made, et cetera. They have a superior knowledge, like you're saying. I mean, what do you do then with that recognition that from below one has a superior knowledge? I think that that knowledge has to be mobilized. I mean, that knowledge has to be mobilized and organized. But it's an important first recognition, because I think that that our assumptions against the possibility of democracy, the assumptions against the possibility that the multitude could be capable of making decisions for a better society are so strong that it's helpful to have recognitions like that that show us the capacities that could be organized.
And I think could is the key word here, right? Because despite the fact that there are, as you say, already existing circuits of cooperation among the multitude, despite the fact that labor, if we agree with you, has achieved a certain kind of autonomy in relationship to the capitalist class, but despite the fact that workers do have more intimate knowledges of, you know, what they're working with and what they're making than the people who oversee their activities, the question is how that all comes together such that the multitude acts in a kind of a unified way, despite their differences, to actually produce strategy that can move a political project of social and political transformation, fundamental transformation, forward.
You're exactly right. And it's important with how you're emphasizing the could, because there's nothing spontaneous about this. There's nothing immediate about this. There's nothing guaranteed about this. It requires organization. But let me try another example that might just simplify these things, because I think it doesn't have to be, I keep posing it at a large scale, and it might be good to start with some smaller scales. I remember being told by friends about a vote in Berlin, in the city of Berlin, a municipal vote some years ago about the electrical system. And the vote was whether to make the electric system common. So what they meant by that was, you know, pre-1989, the electric system was state-run, both east and west in Berlin. So it was public property, you know, property of the state. After 1989, the electric system was private, both east and west. In other words, like in many of the U.S. municipalities, it was electric system was run by private corporations. If we were to make it common, it would mean that the residents of Berlin would be able to make decisions about the most important aspects of it. Like, it's not like all residents of Berlin are electrical engineers. They, of course, don't know all the specifics about, you know, whatever, circuits, etc. But they know enough, and they certainly could know enough, to make decisions like, should we use nuclear energy or not? What should the pricing scales be? Should there be variable pricing for the rich and the poor? Like, these are the kinds of decisions that we could be capable of making. So that's the, it's a good example, I think, because it both touches on the common, which is maybe something worth talking about, but it also shows that, you know, of course there are certain things that certain expertise, you could call it leadership in that sense, is required for. But the really important decisions, what earlier we were talking about in terms of strategy, those really important decisions don't require any greater expertise than everyone could easily attain. And that they're really political decisions about what kind of society we want. And that's the kind of thing that we can and really should develop the capacity to decide together.
Let me ask you about the common. How important is the common to you and Antonio Negri? And You know, when people think about the commons, they think about private property being turned into something else, turned into often public property. Is the common equivalent in your analysis to public property?
Tony and I differentiate the common, well, first from private property, but also from public property, which by public property, we really mean property that is controlled by the state. So there is, of course, greater access to public property, but in that final analysis, it's really the state that decides over it, not us. I mean, what's crucial, I would say, in all of these questions about property and the common is, are really two factors. One is who has access, and the other is who decides. Private property is primarily characterized, even though in first-year law school courses they put it in a more sophisticated way, but I think in our vernacular, our normal way of thinking about it, private property primarily consists of the fact that there's limited access and that there's a monopoly over decision-making. That's what it means to be the owner of something. Public property, in essence, has the access is really controlled by, and the decision-making is controlled by the state. What we want is something different, or what we think of as the common is something different, which would be an open access and democratic mechanisms of decision-making over the use. For instance, the use of a field, or the use of cultural products like music, or you know, variety of other both material and immaterial goods, you know, the use of code. To make it common would mean that you open the access and then have some democratic structure for making decisions about it. That's what we understand by the common.
Right. And so if there is to be some kind of decision-making, some kind of collective decision-making to manage the common and our access to the common, then we need some kind of institutions. And I wonder if you believe that kind of the existing kinds of institutions we see in capitalist society fit the bill, or something more innovative and kind of more appropriate to the kinds of governance we want to establish is in order.
My instinct is often to start with social movements that are, and think about institutions from there. Like, there are several social movements today. In fact, I would say it's a guiding thread in many of the most inspiring social movements today that are demanding the common, even without using that terminology. For instance, the Standing Rock protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline, they were super important in a lot of ways. The extraordinary gathering of North American tribes, the ways that environmentalists followed the lead of indigenous populations. But what really most interests me is that the objection to the pipeline was not in terms of property. You can imagine a property argument, you know, even a property argument that includes the violation of various treaties for the tribes. But it was not that, you know, you can't put this pipeline through because it's going to destroy our property, it's going to destroy our water. No, what the water protectors, some of the leaders at the Dakota Access Pipeline protests were saying at Standing Rock, was that we need to regard the earth differently. In effect, we really need to regard the earth as common, not as property. Like, we need to establish a relationship of care and responsibility with the earth. It seems like the kind of thing I learned from, because, you know, they have a notion of the common in that statement in itself that goes far beyond what Tony and I were imagining, but at least gives you kind of an idea about an argument, a movement that's demanding the common and refusing the logics of private property. And then you would have to organize it. That's what, in fact, that's what you're asking me for, is what would be the institutions that could follow on that and organize the decision-making structures required for the common. You know, here's what Tony and I say as a guide. One thing we propose as a guide is these have to be non-sovereign institutions. By non-sovereign, we don't mean not autonomous. We mean not belonging to traditions of sovereignty, which would be having to do with centralized decision-making and structures of authority, that we need to invent new institutions that can be properly democratic. That's the, in some ways, the question of the common and the question of the organization of democracy completely overlap with one another. And I guess with this too, it'd be tempting, or in such discussions, it's always tempting to ask someone, you know, like, well, how would you do this? What would you do? And one should resist. I think what the kind of theorizing that Tony and I do can contribute are kind of guidelines, conceptual guidelines. I think for the real content of it, that's why my instinct is to go to the movements. I think for the real content of it, you have to look at the kinds of practices and even institutions that people are already developing. I mean, this all goes under the motto of when someone asks you what is to be done, your first response should be, what are people already doing? And like, if you start with what people are already doing, it probably gets you much further than starting with the what is to be done.
Michael Hart, he teaches at Duke University. We're talking about his latest book, co-authored with Antonio Negri. It's called Assembly. It's published by Oxford University Press. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Michael about his book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Michael Hart is based at Duke University. He's a political philosopher and a professor of literature. He co-directs the Social Movements Lab at the John Hope Franklin Humanities Institute. And we are discussing his book, co-authored with Antonio Negri, called Assembly. Before we go on to talk about kind of concrete paths toward the new forms of governance that you advocate for in this book, I do want to kind of bring up an argument. I know it's kind of an old one, but I think listeners might be thinking along the lines of, what about kind of dead-end, low-wage workers, right? Because part of what you're doing is to emphasize the rise of cognitive labor, right? Sort of labor that has a certain kind of expertise in relation to machines and machine systems, digitalization, communication technologies. A lot of these people are, a lot of workers are immiserated and are working in very difficult, menial jobs that doesn't allow, perhaps, and maybe you could tell me otherwise, doesn't allow for the kind of social cooperation and social production that you and Antonio Negri emphasize. So how do we think about those people not just being part of the multitude, but being part of the productive capacities, subversive capacities of the multitude as part of our group that can help strategize toward a better future?
Yeah, that's really important. I mean, I think first, and one should add to what you're saying too, that, you know, even in the various high-tech communications industries, for every software programmer, there's 100 people doing click work in a room of just, you know, entering data, et cetera. So it's not as if any of these jobs are a guarantee of some sort of revolutionary capacity. I think it's important. That's two things I would say as starting points. Tony and I have resisted many of our friends, and this was starting with friends of ours in France, that were focused on recognizing the new forms of labor in terms of, you know, what they were calling cognitive labor, the formation of a cognitariat. And what we were resisting is that new forms of labor, you know, moving out of industrial assembly line, were involved just with the questions of intelligence. You know, so what one of the things that seemed to us to important to add to that is to also focus on affective forms of labor, which of course has a strong gendered component. You know, if one thinks about the kinds of affective labor in various kinds of labor that involve service, flight attendants was a classic example, but it's also true, I suppose, in education, variety of waiting tables, you know, forms of work that involve yeah, here we say construction of affects, you might call it emotional work, where a primary part of the job is actually managing people's affective lives. You know, that's what you do when you wait tables. Or what do flight attendants do? They actually have to be nice to people who are jerks to them, or they sell a kind of friendship, something like that. If one thinks about also that, just a first move of thinking about affective work, in addition to what you were talking about, the cognitive notion, you know, the intellectual notion, it broadens out quite a bit. And you recognize that there, too, there's a great deal of expertise, I guess. But really, it's not expertise I'm after so much. There's a great deal of already constructed networks of social cooperation. Like, that's what's going on. You know, think of, for instance, the hospice worker. You know, so the hospice worker working with someone during the last 6 months of their life. And this is also very gendered form of work. But what does that work involve? I mean, of course, there are a lot of material tasks about tending to the wounds and measuring out medication. But a large part of the work, well, is helping someone die, an amazing affective work, but also managing the networks of, you know, the family networks, or the friendship networks of the dying person. Like, this is an extraordinary capacity. Yeah, so if we would think about, you know, earlier we were talking about the pride of the industrial auto worker, that the workers themselves know how the entire system works. Here, too, this is an incredible knowledge of the ability to construct social networks. I mean, this is not some image of liberation. In some ways, it's more horrible when your abilities to love or your abilities to create affects are done for a wage. I mean, it might be worse. It might be more exploitative. I'm not saying that. But it's an enormous capacity. That's where I want. And it's in a capacity that involves the construction of networks of social cooperation. So that's one enlargement, it seems to me, not just the cognitive, but also the affective. But the other is that we should also enlarge the notion of labor or the production of value from the wage scene to also unwaged scenes of reproductive labor in the home, but also the kinds of constructions of community that happen all the time and that also involve the kinds of production of value that capital manages to capture, to extract. So if one expands it in that way, it's true, of course. I mean, I'm not singing the praises of, you know, working at 7-Eleven, like, by all means. But I do think it's important to recognize in the ways that a lot of people produce social values, even social values that are able to be captured by capital, how that involves the construction of social networks, or, as we were talking about earlier, the production of circuits of cooperation. That's what, I mean, in some ways we're looking for that. I mean, it's true that some people are isolated and don't communicate with others and don't work with others in any way. I wouldn't deny that's true. But one shouldn't neglect the variety of ways that people at the paid work and also in other parts of their life construct these extraordinary social networks of cooperation. And that's what we're looking at.
There are a variety of paths that you and Antonio Negri see that potentially could lead toward a better future and a more sane and humane and just society. And since we don't have a lot of time left, I'm going to summarize each one of them. The first path that you list is called exodus. It's withdrawing from dominant institutions and creating or trying to create an alternative outside them, and you point to prefigurative politics as an important example of this. The second is reformism, but not just reformism, antagonistic reformism, which is has as its goal a fundamental transformation of power. It's not just like tinkering around the edges and making things better for a few people. And the third path is taking power, kind of taking over and creating the institutions of a new society. And as you have said earlier, you think these institutions need to be new, non-sovereign institutions, not in the mold of institutions that have grown up and developed around sovereign forms of power. So which of these paths make the most sense to you? You don't outright reject any of them, although I could see, and I think our listeners could see that, you know, they're there's some contradiction. Like if you took all three, or you kind of went down all three paths at the same time, there would be a bit of confusion and a lot of fragmentation. So can you share with us what path you see makes the most sense, or what combination of paths make the most sense?
Tony and I are taking for granted that, you know, that readers and activists of various sorts will recognize these three. You know, they seem to us as three primary strategies that we've inherited from the movements of recent decades, and that people will not only recognize the three, but also recognize the limitations of each. You know, that of prefigurative politics, the way they sometimes, first of all, don't last. Also, it's difficult to live in that prefigurative world while in the larger society, that it comes to be drowned by the whole. This notion of antagonistic reformism, you know, which sometimes goes by the slogan of the long march through the institutions. It seems often people enter the institutions and get lost in that long march and never end up transforming them. And the third, taking power, it often ends up, you know, with a change of personnel, but the similar structures of power. So I think it does, I mean, while criticizing each of them, you could criticize each of them and say, well, okay, that's it. There's no hope. You know, we're done. I think for Tony and I, it is more like you suggested, that it only makes sense to us to think about these in conjunction. And I don't think it has to be fragmented. Like, let me give you, this is a theoretical example. I probably should give you a practical one too, but it's a theoretical one that's dear to me. So Gilles Deleuze, French philosopher I've been very fond of, he did this beautiful video documentary in which the interviewer went through the alphabet and for each letter gave him a concept that then he was supposed to respond to. In French, the interviewer got to G, letter G, and gave him the concept gauche, gauche meaning left in French. And Deleuze, the philosopher, immediately responds, there is no such thing as a government of the left. What there can be is a government that gives space to the left. And I love this idea because it does give some sense of that combination, like that I think it makes sense today to take power only insofar as that power makes space available for new prefigurative experiments and is opening itself to the kinds of even antagonistic reformism within itself, so that taking power in a way of what we're calling the sovereign mold really doesn't seem to us like a path. And neither is a path, yeah, like I said, either the other two alone. But the means of working in some ways simultaneously through these three strategies seems to me to make sense. So here's a practical example. At least it in parts corresponds. I have been, and I'm sure many other listeners have been, inspired by the municipal government in Barcelona, in Spain. And one of the nice things about the Barcelona en Comú is the name of the party. And one of the nice things is that it really did evolve out of the movements beginning in 2011. In some ways, the evolution of the movements, the evolution of demands of the movements came up to this electoral experiment, but it was an electoral experiment, you know, of a party that was elected in power to run the city. It was an electoral experiment that wasn't a negation of the movements. It wasn't like, you know, okay, now we have a party, you all can go home, we'll take care of things from now on. No, it's rather one that works in conjunction with the movement still existing, often in antagonistic ways. So that seems to me a practical example of thinking some conjunction among these different strategies. Yeah, that might, you know, that may, when we were first talking about them, maybe they could seem, at first glance, they could seem mutually exclusive, you know, or contradictory with one another. And that's what I'm trying to work through, you know, maybe not completely coherently, but I'm trying to work through the ways in which they can be not only compatible, but mutually reinforcing.
One thing that brings a lot of people together is general strikes. How important is a general strike or the weapon of the general strike to the possible revival of the left?
I've been super inspired in the last year by a movement that I know mostly from Argentina, but that exists for many other places in Latin America and in Italy. in Argentina called Ni Una Menos, literally not one less, but meaning like not one more should die. It's really starting against femicides and against sexual violence. And one of the things, so it's been a mass movement against that in Argentina, you know, sometimes around March 8th, International Women's Day, but also in other things. And one of the practices of Ni Una Menos, of this movement in Argentina, is to try to reinvent the strike, the concept of strike. And really what they've been doing in feminist collectives in different parts of society is say, what does it mean to you to strike? Like, so there's certain worker collectives of women that, you know, to what it means to them to strike is easily recognizable in the classical sense, you know, stop the workplace, stop the point of production. But there are a lot of other feminist collectives that aren't on the factory floor and are not even organized around a workplace, but they are innovating what it means to strike at a social level, you know, to stop the city, to stop the functioning of normal forms of power. Like that's what, I think that's a really important innovation. So in their case, I guess I would say either they're transforming, you know, shifting the question there about general strike, or maybe rather interpreting what general strike means in terms of social strike. Like, what does it mean to strike not against a specific workplace, even against the entire set of workplaces? That's the way the general strike had conventionally been conceived, but rather in a social frame. What does it mean to strike in that sense? And I think that's a really important organizational question. It could also flow from our earlier part of the conversation, insofar that, you know, part of the hypothesis that Tony and I have when reading contemporary forms of capital, insofar as capitalist production is today primarily social production, that involves a certain amount of analysis, but insofar as production is primarily social production, then the strike must become a social strike. It must be a strike not simply against workplaces, not even simply against capital, but on a social scale, or on capital insofar as it exists on a social scale. That's where, that, at least that's where I would orient a discussion around strike and do it through what the Argentinian feminists are doing.
Michael Hart, he teaches at Duke University. His and Antonio Negri's new book is Assembly. Michael, thank you for your work and thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.